Good morning, I'm Justin Landon, and this is Rocket Talk, the Tor.com podcast. It is 6 a.m., and I'm awake for a very particular reason. Joe Abercrombie is with us today. He's the author of 6 novels and 5 short stories, including the First Law trilogy. His 7th novel, Half a King, comes out on July 8th. Welcome, Joe.
Welcome. I should point out, it's not 6 in the morning here. I don't get up early for this kind of thing.
No, it's like
midday.
Noon, right? Yeah, midday.
Yeah. Midday all the way.
That's very nice.
Thank you.
Good for you.
Yes.
So,
lovely to be here.
Oh, I'm glad. I'm glad it's lovely. Are you nervous at all coming into this conversation? I mean, I've written like 70,000 words about you so far during the First Law trilogy reread on Tor.com, so that's a bit stalkerish. Do I make you nervous?
No, not at all. I was just, I've got a couple of questions lined up, and then I was just going to let you talk about how great I am. That seems to be, the easy thing here.
Well, that's really the purpose of a reread, right, is really just to wax about how amazing something is. In fact,
all those ingenious nuances that neither you nor I realized were there.
Well, it's funny, every time I say something negative about you, I always notice that there's a little bit of a comment that's been edited out by the moderation team. I tell you, your fans get really upset when I say something not entirely glowing about you.
That's interesting to me, because there always seems to be an awful lot of people queuing up to say things that are not entirely glowing about me whenever I post anything online. So I guess it cuts both ways, doesn't it?
Yeah, I just gather that most people online, they're not most people, but everybody's got a few people online that don't want to say anything nice. I guess that's just...
The extreme opinions are heard the loudest, definitely.
That's right. So before we really get started in earnest, I feel compelled to ask you if you're watching the World Cup. Here in the States, we're led to believe that the entire British nation is sort of holding a dagger to Wayne Rooney's throat.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a huge football fan myself. I mean, I follow the World Cup and the European Cup and the big international competition, certainly, but I'm not hugely interested in the national side particularly. I'm not massively partisan. I'd rather watch good matches between interesting teams, which usually means the England games aren't that interesting to me. We tend to underperform very badly on the international stage. Not as fantasy authors, I hurry to point out, but as footballers, we seem to. So I catch the odd game, but it's odd. It's kind of passed me by a bit this year. I think because I no longer watch a lot of terrestrial TV. It's really revealed to me how my own habits have changed. When you watch terrestrial TV, you see so many adverts, so many World Cup-related things are just fired at you the whole time, and you're aware that it's coming, when every match is on. But now that I tend to watch everything on box sets or streamed, I don't see a lot of the World Cup stuff these days. It's sort of oddly passed me by in a weird way.
Do you refer to it as terrestrial television?
Terrestrial television, yeah, we do, yeah. Well, maybe we did 50 years ago, and I just haven't caught up yet, I don't know.
That's the first time I've ever heard that.
Network, you'd say, would you? Yeah. Network TV.
Yeah, yeah, no, I love terrestrial TV. That makes it sound so backward-looking.
It does. Well, it is these days, isn't it,
We find ourselves watching more and more streaming these days, of course, because our children don't allow us to do much appointment viewing. That's how it works, I guess.
They want Power Rangers right now. They don't realize that there was a time when, you were lucky to get Indiana Jones at Christmas and you'd take what you were given.
Yeah, no, I can't get my daughter off her iPhone. I mean, she's 4 and a half and she's already like better at things than I am. It really pisses me off.
Oh, well, it's just one of many things to be pissed off about. That's the purpose of life, isn't it?
Yeah, I am having, I'm already having performance anxiety as a father, much like the entire English nation during the World Cup.
Well, absolutely, yeah. Why not? I mean, performance anxiety is a fixture of life, really, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was going to ask some other asinine small talk questions, but then you just tweeted your cover for Locus magazine, and I have to comment. Yeah. Nice side profile arm on knee picture.
Oh, man, yeah. I mean, I totally propped that wrist on that knee. It was,
It's really a staple of fantasy author cover shoots, I feel like. Did you actually sit for a photo shoot, or is that your professional photographer spouse providing Locus with a photo?
No, that was shot at Fantasy Con in Brighton, World Fantasy Convention in Brighton, I think. Locus had their own photographer there, and so they took some photographs of me perching in a stairwell, as I do, as I am to be found most days on the stairwell of a hotel, perched. Yeah, the whole thing, I mean, it's just so natural. And that's the look that you get. It's funny for me to see that, actually, because I can remember seeing copies of Locus, some years ago, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, around the time my first book came out, and thinking, that's just not me. I'd never be that guy perched on a stairwell on the front of Locus. And yet now there I am, you know. I don't know if I've changed or if Locus have changed. Maybe a bit of both.
Mind you, with a flip.
We've both come down in the world. They've come down in the world and I've come up. Maybe that would be more accurate.
I buy that. I personally appreciate the floating rapier.
Absolutely. I mean, rapiers do float after all, don't they? They're known for that.
I don't suppose that was the rapier was not floating. You weren't gazing into the rapier's eyes in the photo set.
There was no rapier there. They must have used some kind of digital trickery to bring that in. I don't remember there being one. I think I would have noticed.
Clearly, Locus is upping their game with their after shoot.
They've entered the 21st century. Why can't you, Justin?
I know. It's that terrestrial television.
Terrestrial magazines.
Yes. So you may not be aware of a fun detail that I'll bring up before we get started talking about your new book, is I actually got sent Brent Weeks' copy of Half a King. The letter that was addressed to him and was sent to me said, "Dear Brent Weeks." Do you think people are confusing Brent and I? I don't have a red beard, but I think people may be confusing us.
Well, I mean, you obviously have that very similar physique. So, you know, as an outline, I can see how the two of you could easily be mistaken one for the other. Take that how you will.
Sure, and he's, you know, rampantly successful. I'm rampantly successful.
Exactly. You both have a similar stature within the bookselling community.
Yeah, absolutely. People are just tearing themselves apart for a blurb from me.
So I don't think... No, it doesn't surprise me, really. I'm interested now to know whether he got one saying also, "Dear Brent Weeks." Did they all say that?
Actually, we discussed it. His did not say, "Dear Brent Weeks." I don't know if it
did. His say, "Dear Justin."
I don't know. We haven't confirmed that, but it was a fun exchange because I wanted
that
to
brings
make sure.
Up the possibility that he there was a specially personalized one intended for him, whereas yours was just, you know, routine.
Yes,
it was just
right.
One of many.
And I was actually very concerned that Brent Weeks didn't get a copy of your book, so I ensured that he did, because I knew that his blurb would be slightly more important than mine own.
Well, that's very big of you.
As you know, Brent Weeks and I are of a similar stature, so...
Well, exactly. Both known as big guys inside and out.
Right. Now, if I've been keeping up, it seems like you've got quite a list of authors who have blurbed the book. Pat Rothfuss, the aforementioned... Brent Weeks, Rick Reardon, Mike Cole, Robin Hobb. I'm sure there have been a lot of others. Is it gratifying to see your peers kind of praise the book, or do you sort of just take it as your due?
Oh, well, funny enough, you've anticipated me. I was just going to say, I mean, no, this is, you know, they only prove their own good taste when they queue up to, you know, offer me the congratulations that I richly and rightly deserve. Really. More seriously. Yeah, it is great, obviously. It's fantastic. And I mean, the response to this book has been particularly really, really good. I mean, because it's a step into slightly, you know, partly into slightly new waters for me, I've kind of approached some people like Rick Reardon and Derek Landy, who, you know, are slightly more in that young adult arena to talk about as well. And it's been amazing, the reaction. Of course, the problem I find now is that these people have said nice things about me, and now their publicists and editors will, of course, you know, send me their books. And what do I do then? Tough position to be in.
You're gonna have to actually start reading more in the genre, perhaps.
Well, you say more. I may have to actually read something in the genre. Yeah, but that'll be nice, I think, in a way. But no, it's been fantastic to have people say nice things, and there's been a real spread of different people, all of whom have been great about it. Robin Hobb read it very, very early, as a manuscript, I think, and you know, it was very positive. And some George Martin guy, I hadn't heard of him, I wasn't familiar with him, but apparently he sells reasonably well, so it's nice to have you know, a comment from someone like that.
I was not aware that the Germ had blurbed your book. That's
the Germ has indeed, and indeed it's splattered massively all over the front of both UK and US editions. His name, in fact, on the quote, appears almost larger than mine does on the front of the book.
I can't imagine why. I think it reminds me of when Peter Brett blurbed Mark Lawrence's book. I believe they put it on both the front and the back of the book.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. Yeah, you
it
know,
was so good, we said it twice.
Yeah, exactly. So I have read Half a King, but the vast majority.
You lucky bastard.
I am lucky.
Isn't it good?
It's very good.
Oh, thank you.
I will speak highly of it whenever somebody asks me directly to my face. If give us a little pitch for Half a King, though, since most of the people have not read it. What's it about?
Well, Half a King is basically the tale of Prince Yavi, who is the youngest son of a warlike king in a kind of a slightly Viking-esque Dark Ages society, I suppose you'd say, in which a man is supposed to be a man and to pull an oar and tie a knot and draw a bow and above all hold a shield for the man at his shoulder in the shield wall and be a man's manly man. And Prince Yavi, unfortunately, has been born with a malformed, withered left hand. So he's unable to do any of these things. They're expected of a man, and especially, indeed, of a king or the son of a king. And so he's been relegated, rather, to a kind of position as an apprentice to a minister, sort of a diplomat and advisor and a keeper of knowledge, which is a very important role, but traditionally a woman's role. So he's been learning how to do this, how to read and other strange skills that these people require. When suddenly his father and his older brother are unexpectedly betrayed and murdered, and Yavi is pushed into becoming king himself and has to try and survive in that role using the cunning and the knowledge that he's learned as a minister to overcome much more direct and physical enemies, both outside his kingdom and within. I guess that would be my short pitch.
That's pretty good.
Thanks, man. It's almost as if I've had some practice at doing
that. Yeah, almost. Knot tying, really? Is that really the mark of manhood in the history of the Vikings?
Well, you know, it's a major part of it. And, you know, try doing it with one hand. Not easy. Not easy.
No, although I do find teeth is an excellent tool to tighten a knot often. But or to undo a knot.
You're saying that I missed a trick here.
Well, I'm just saying.
I suppose he could have drawn a bow with his teeth as well. Huh? Or held the shield in his teeth.
I'm fairly certain a horse did that in some Disney film.
He did, yeah, in Tangled. Yeah, yeah. He fought with the sword in his mouth. It's yeah. Like I'm going for a more realistic kind of tone.
Oh, clearly.
On the whole.
Clearly.
If I can. Yeah.
So Half a King is ostensibly being talked about as a young adult novel, and you've already sort of hinted at the fact that you're moving into somewhat of a new territory. There was quite a bit of consternation about that among your fans when it was announced. You probably heard it more than I did. I imagine when you announced that you were writing a fantasy western, there wasn't exactly like an outcry of, Joe Abercrombie's gone soft.
Well, a bit, you know. Though, I mean, there was not entirely dissimilar reactions in some ways to that. What is this? What is this? This is weird. I don't like it. I mean, certainly you always get some of that, regardless of what you do, I think. And the reaction to this is kind of, it's an odd one, because I'm not sure exactly where you place it. And where people place it has been a bit varied. So it's certainly being, you know, in the US, they're selling it more on the adult side. In the UK, they're kind of selling it betwixt the two, young adult and adult. They're always so mutable, these categories. It all depends on, you know, what you've done before, what your established readers are, what your publisher is, a whole range of things. So it's hard to say, but I mean, certainly it was aimed, you know, in part at younger readers, but I also very much wanted to write something that would, you know, work for the readers that I already had. And I think, you know, my basic standpoint with YA was always that, you know, young adults are adults, just young ones. You know, they're not all that different in terms of the kind of thing they want to read to what old adults want to read. I mean, I have a lot of, believe it or not, 10, 11, 12-year-old readers for my adult fiction as well. I'm not sure what they make of some of the steamier scenes, but, so, you know, I get emails from people of that age. And at 12 or 14, I was reading a whole range of, you know, stuff, young adult, very adult, classic, complicated fiction of all kinds. So I really didn't modify things too massively. And so I think the reaction from people who haven't read it is maybe, YA, huh? Especially from people who, you know, aren't that familiar with YA, because I think it gets a bad rap often from, you know, people who don't read it. But the idea was really just to write, you know, the kind of book that I like to read. Nothing too radically different from what I've written before. I think the main difference, in a way, is more in the structure and the length, you know, because it's shorter, a tighter, a more focused style, really, than it is in the content necessarily. And also having a young adult central character is not something I've necessarily done before. I've tended to work much more with these kind of old, used up people with a lot of history, whose characters are already very defined, who are often kind of struggling to change an already very long established and quite unpleasant often personality. So writing a book which has a young adult protagonist who's very much being formed, who's coming of age, who is discovering themselves and discovering the adult world, I think that naturally gives it a slightly different tenor, a different feel. But overall, I think it's still very much the kind of book I've written before.
Well, and so that's kind of one of the questions I wanted to get at was...
I've answered about 10 questions there, haven't I?
You actually did.
You can't shut me up when you get going.
But I'm going to follow up on all of them, so it's fine. But one of the things that occurred to me as I was reading it was, stylistically, this is, or structurally, it's a coming-of-age story. And coming-of-age is something that we see a lot of in YA, but it's also something that we see a lot of in fantasy in general, whether it's adult or young adult or whatever else. That coming-of-age story is like a natural trope, or if you will, within the fantasy genre. And it's not something you've explored in the past. I mean, you could make a case that Shy South or Jizal or Manza are sort of coming-of-age in their own fucked up kind of way. But yeah. At least in the traditional sense of a young person moving into the adult
coming
world.
Coming of mid-30s.
Right. Coming to adulthood rather late than the rest of us.
Yeah.
But you haven't done it in the classic sense that we're sort of familiar with from hero's journey, standard, you know, Byron's Roman type thing, which you're clearly doing here. And so it's a little bit of a throwback in that regard to sort of some of the epic fantasies that we've seen. Did the desire to tell that kind of story drive the fact that you ended up in young adult, or did you set out from the beginning to write a book that would appeal to younger readers?
I think more the latter than the former. I mean, I don't think I set out to do coming of age. I mean, I think coming of age, in a way, it happens automatically when the characters are that age. It kind of has to. You know, if they're 15, 16, 17, 18, you know, going through adolescence, facing adulthood for the first time, facing responsibility, you know, deciding on their identity, all those things, that's kind of inevitable in the story. I think the genesis of it, in a way, was more a desire to do something slightly different. Having written these six, you know, pretty big, not necessarily by epic fantasy standards, but by most standards, pretty big, complicated, in-depth, epic books, I kind of felt the need to recharge the batteries a little, to try a different world, I guess. Somewhere I could start from scratch and tell something very quick and sharp and focused. And so, you know, a young adult book seemed to be a good match for that type of story, really. The one thing you really need in a young adult book, it's infinitely mutable, especially these days, but you always need a young adult protagonist. So that was kind of essential from the start. I'd had this meeting a few years before with Nick Lake, who's one of the editors of Harper King, and he's a young adult publisher at HarperCollins. So a few years ago, I had a meeting with him, and he was, you know, saying that he liked my adult stuff, which called his taste into question immediately, obviously. I should have just gone at that moment. I should have known. But and he thought I had a good young adult book in me, basically. So he was kind of picking my brains to see if I'd be interested in doing it. At the time, I was obviously, you know, busy with all the other stuff, but the idea lurked in my head. So the seed was sort of there already, waiting for the right idea, in a way. And when I finished Red Country, it seemed like the right time to take a breather from the first stuff, I suppose, and then try and hand something slightly different. And in writing, you know, a much shorter, tighter book with a single young adult point of view, I guess, you know, it inevitably becomes, in a sense, a coming-of-age story.
Now, a lot of YA is written in first person. I've often heard it described that the nature of a YA novel is sort of the immediacy of the emotion, less describing what's happening and more about how what's happening is affecting the emotional state of the narrator. Obviously, you've gone with a third-person narrative in this book, although it's so tightly focused on Yarvi that it's sort of that same idea, I guess. But did you dabble at all with a first-person narrative, or did you just go with third-person from the beginning?
Yeah, I didn't with this. I have done before. the first lore stuff, funnily enough, the Dogman was written in first person in the original version. And it worked really well. Or at least it seemed to me. But I think rightly, my editors felt that it kind of skewed everything and made that character seem kind of more important than the others. And rather than an ensemble piece, you kind of get, why is this character sort of the central character, the me, the I, and the others come in and out. So I rewrote him to be, you know, third person as it is in the final book. And ever since then, I've really found third person limited, as they call it, to be the kind of most effective way for me to write. I think it sort of gives you, you do lose a fraction of the immediacy, a fraction of that kind of intimate, personal, totally all involved connection, if you like, with the central character. But you can get all of that back in the way that you write and in the way you communicate the ideas and the feelings of the person. You can still get a lot of that across, and at the same time you can slightly vary your kind of closeness to the character. So you can write some characters a bit closer to their thoughts, a bit closer to their feelings, some characters slightly more distant. There's a lot more versatility to it, I find. And so it just seemed the right tool to pick up for Half a King as well, even though there's only the single point of view. In the next book, Half the World, there's two alternating points of view, two different ones, new ones. So Yavi's kind of in the background still, but there's two different points of view, and so they're written in a slightly different way, and for that, I find Third Person Limited is a better option. So it's just kind of the way that has always felt to me, like it makes the best sense.
At least on the UK side, discussions on writing this series had been ongoing for a while with Harper. As you kind of took this to market in the United States, did you see any resistance on the YA side that Half a King needed to have more of blank to be a YA novel? I mean, we often hear that YA novels must have romance or they must have this or that. Did you encounter any of that as you took it out?
Not really. No, I mean, it was interesting. I suppose, you know, on the HarperCollins thing, it was we had this meeting and then nothing happened for 3 years, I suppose. So it wasn't as though there was a sort of ongoing arrangement to do that. It was just the seed was planted and then, you know, I wrote the thing and put it out there, and they were one of the, I think there were six publishers who were, you know, interested in it. Obviously, the fact that, you know, Nick had come to me in the first place made me interested in working with him, because I think he's got a very good instinct as well.
Nice humble brag, stuff. Nice humble brag there.
Thank you. Well, I mean, was there something humble about it? I must have missed the humble part. I mean,
it went to auction with six publishers, in case you were wondering.
Oh well, there were more involved initially, but there were six that were taken seriously towards the end. Just to make that point. There were a few anyway, but I mean, what I was going to come on to say, to make it slightly worthwhile rather than purely a bragging point, was that there was quite a range of different publishers. There were sort of three adult fantasy imprints. There were two kind of more mainstream imprints. Well, there were two fantasy imprints, two more general mainstream imprints, one children's one, and one kind of collaboration between adult fantasy and YA. And the way they presented the book, the way they thought about the book, the way they talked about publishing it, you know, varied according to the emphasis of the publisher, in a way. So they all had different ideas about where they'd focus it, I suppose. Some, you know, the adult fantasy imprints tended to look at it as adult fantasy and to think about selling it in that way. The children's one saw it more as a straight-up young adult book. The general fiction imprint saw it as general fiction. So it's kind of interesting. I mean, in the US, there were three, chiefly, two adult fantasy imprints and one young adult imprint. None of them particularly wanted to massively change what the content was. It was more just a case of the emphasis on the way they try and sell it, I think. There was nothing in the first book that anyone has ever, I don't think, kind of demanded come out because of the young adult taste or the young adult, you know, the necessity of the market. I was writing, you know, I was kind of conscious of who I was writing for from the start. So, you know, the tone was a bit different from what I've done with the adult books. It certainly wasn't the same. It wasn't as though I wrote the entire thing, then just took all the swears out afterwards. you know, I was kind of conscious that I had to write it in a way and with a feel that was a bit different, but not massively different. And then the second book, there's just been one, I think there was one paragraph, maybe two paragraphs, focusing on an area close to my heart, that of erectile dysfunction, that had to be removed. Yeah. But otherwise the entire thing was fine. And you know, I mean, there's no sex in the first book, but it certainly is in the second. And the violence is still pretty intense. I think, you know, what you can get away with in a young adult book, if the package is coherent and makes sense and the atmosphere is right, is pretty much anything, honestly. You know, there are young adult books with lots of harsh language. There are young adult books with very intense violence, young adult books with sex and pregnancy and all those kind of hard issues being tackled. So I don't think it's at all the straitjacket that, you know, some people maybe think it is. I don't think that the teeth need to be pulled from it at all. It can still be quite honest and raw. And you can find ways, you know, to write things that don't require immensely explicit language, if you like, without it feeling false.
I do enjoy the fact that we can have plenty of blood splatter, but discussions of erectile dysfunction or overt swearing is a real problem.
Yeah, because, I mean, how many of us have murdered someone and how many of us have suffered occasionally from erectile dysfunction? And yet one is taboo. It's kind of weird, isn't it?
Well, or just sex, just sex in general.
Sex in general, for sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Sort of strange. I hope that in the sex in the second book, you've liberally used onomatopoeia, which is a literary device that we've all come to know and love in your sex scenes.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm a big fan of onomatopoeia generally. You know, I think the language should reflect the essence of what is happening. And therefore, naturally, you would apply that to, you know, the most intense moments in the characters' lives more than anywhere else. Therefore, I submit that onomatopoetic sex is definitely the way to go.
Have you ever done a reading of one of your sex scenes at a convention or something like that?
This is the reason why I never ask the audience what they'd like me to read, because I know the answer will immediately be, I'd like you to read your hardest and most unpleasant sex scene, please. Which is always going to be a little bit of a tough sell, isn't it, to a crowd?
The Logan and Pharaoh sex, I mean, just the number of squelches, I think, would be a real challenge. But it would provide an excellent opportunity for your acting chops,
I think. Yeah, and you know, I think once you've written it, you've got to own it. You just got to own it, and you've got to do it. You've got to read that and mean it. You got to believe it.
You do
really
do
deliver.
You do excellent readings, though. I had a chance to see you do a reading in Confusion a few years ago, and you were very good. Robin Hobb was enraptured by your.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I thought she did an excellent reading as well. Actually, I was really impressed with what she had to, because I wasn't familiar with her Megan Lindholm stuff at all, and it was very effective actually. But I really enjoy reading, and you know, I think it's a very live and interesting opportunity to kind of connect with readers in a way you don't otherwise get.
Yeah, I think it's one of the rare things that some authors are good at and some are not, because it's a totally different medium. It's sort of a performance art as opposed to just sort of reading what's on the page. And
And I mean, writing as a discipline of sitting staring at a screen is as unperformance, as unpublicly engaged as you could possibly be. So I think in a way I quite enjoy those opportunities to, you know, have some social interaction with readers and to connect with people. Though you wouldn't want to be doing too much of it. I mean, I can imagine it getting to be quite a grind when you've got lots and lots of events to do. I've got quite a lot to do for this book, so, you know, I'm looking forward to it, but also slightly nervous about hitting the road for a month or two.
Are you touring in the UK only, or are you coming to the States?
I'm coming to the States. Well, I'm coming to the West Coast. It's very hard to kind of do a comprehensive tour of the States if you're not based in the States, you know, and able to do different legs and things. I kind of get the feeling that, you know, the tour as a concept is getting harder and harder to justify. I guess there would have been a time when a reader's only chance to meet an author and, you know, connect with them and talk to them and ask them questions would have been at sort of bookshop events on a tour. I don't know. It was never something I ever considered doing. I never even thought about it as a reader. I think these days with the internet and, you know, people are so available on the internet, you can email someone and get an answer in 10 seconds or tweet them, you know. So it's not got the same impact that it did have. And even though it's something that brick and mortar stores can offer, which of course, you know, Amazon and other digital retailers can't offer that contact with the author, it feels like it's, you know, it's tough to get people out actually. And even with really well-known authors, you know, you might do really dud events. You hear about people turning up to empty rooms and so on. Every author has those kind of war stories. So it's a tough thing to justify, but I'm doing, I think maybe 14 or 15 events in the UK. In the UK, obviously, you can kind of, because the distances are so much smaller, you can do a lunchtime signing in one city, then get a train onto another and do an evening event there. In the US, I think I'm doing, it's based around Comic-Con in San Diego, so I'll be there. But I'm doing an event in Seattle, I think, the first night, then fly down to San Diego. Then I'm doing an event in San Diego alongside the stuff at Comic-Con. And then I think I'm doing one in LA, one in San Francisco. And then I'm in Santa Fe with George, amazingly. He's going to interview me in his cinema, I understand.
Oh, yeah, I've heard good things about the cinema.
I've heard the cinema's amazing, yeah.
Yeah, when I interviewed Sam Sykes here on Rocket Talk, we had a discussion about the cinema and whether or not it was the first step in George R. R. Martin's sort of like dominance of New Mexico.
Right, yeah, yeah. Well, I think, you know, he's well on the way, isn't he?
Yeah, certainly. Mayor of Santa Fe is just right around the corner. Next stop, you know, world domination. But, yeah, no, I think the touring thing is really a challenge these days, and I think the only way it seems to work is when you tie it to sort of like the super genre bookstores in the US, like Mysterious Galaxy Borderlands and things like that, where you've got that built-in audience. When you go to a Barnes & Noble, it's just like sort of shouting into the ether.
Yeah, and absolutely. And I mean, the difference between an amazing event and a rubbish event absolutely is the kind of the bookstore and the booksellers and their connection with their customers and their expertise in the area. I mean, I went to Australia last year, I guess it was, end of last year, maybe the year before, God. And I did, you know, events in Sydney and Brisbane and the big cities. But by far the best event I did was in Hobart, which is, you know, tiny. In Tasmania, tiny little town in Tasmania, really. But with an amazing bookstore, with a bookseller who was, you know, very skilled, very positive, big fan of my stuff, had hand sold loads of my stuff to many of his customers, and we ended up with kind of 150 people in a pub. So it was kind of a brilliant event, and that, I guess, just demonstrates how important it is to have, you know, quality, speciality bookstores with great, energetic expert booksellers.
Speaking of sales, you must be a little relieved that you're not one of the authors currently this moment going to suffer from the challenges that Amazon is levying against some publishers. You seem to have dodged that bullet by the skin of your teeth.
Well, I mean, not with Half a King, but the other
right.
The standalones that are with Orbit in the States, they're affected by it, I guess.
And your Gallant stuff in the UK could be as well, right?
If it spreads, yeah, very, very definitely. And, you know, that would be not great. I mean, no one's celebrating, that's for sure. Obviously, I'm very lucky in that, you know, Half King, I mean, it's books that are about to come out, really, or books that are coming out and are having their big moment in the sun, their blaze of publicity, if you like. You know, if Half King was with Hachette and it was being affected now, that'd be pretty serious. That'd be really gutting and probably financially quite it'd be bad for the book without a doubt. So it's not great. No, it's not great. And if it spreads further, it's going to get more not great without a doubt. Yeah. It's a tough thing for an author because you want to. Kind of maintain some independence. You want to feel you're doing the right thing, but at the same time, you desperately need the support of people like Amazon, of the big booksellers, of, you know, potentially supermarkets, of bookstore chains. You know, you're conscious of how much you rely on them. You really do.
As someone who's pretty established in the field, do you still get nervous with a new book? I mean, is your wife like locking you in the shed until the first month sales are out?
Well, she's not locking me in the shed. She's probably locking herself in the shed in order to get away from me is more likely. Yeah, I mean, absolutely you get nervous, I think. Especially with something like this, which is, you know, a different publisher, a different demographic potentially, slightly different strand of work, something a bit new. Oh, sorry, it's my phone.
That was great.
Little snatch of Iron Maiden there. You definitely get nervous. I definitely do anyway. I get nervous with every book that comes out, for sure. You're never sure how things will go down. However well a book's received, you're always thinking to yourself. And the other thing is, you know, when this book comes out, the second one will be written and pretty much ready to go. So even if people love this first one, I'll be thinking, how will they take the second one? It's very hard, actually, in a way. You're constantly a little bit nervous about how things will go down. And you never feel that, you know, a book is totally accepted. I don't think you're ever absolutely happy with the range of response it gets. I think as well, there's always a degree to which the more successful a book is, the more it comes into contact with people who don't like it. Game of Thrones, say, is being read by a vast and diverse range of people in a way that a lot of fantasy maybe isn't. A lot of fantasy maybe, you know, is playing to the gallery in a way, is preaching to the choir. And the wider your stuff's read, the more, you know, diverse, strange, difficult, unpleasant opinion you'll be subjected to.
I got some questions on Twitter and Facebook. I just asked on Twitter and Facebook if anybody wanted to ask you a question, and I know this is probably going to come as no surprise to you, although it came to one as me. Really, all anybody wants to know is, when are they going to see Logan Ninefingers again?
Okay. Yeah. This is what you always dream of hearing, isn't it? I think you can never get away from that kind of question. But I also think you're asked that question right up until the moment that everyone doesn't want to hear any more from that character, if you like.
Right. It's interesting to me, because I'm sort of in the place where, like, every time you finished his story, like with First Law, I was like, God, I feel like I got the end of Logan's story, you know. And then you did it again in Red Country, and I feel like I've got the end of it. But there are a lot of readers that always want more from that character that they fall in love with.
Yeah, which is a great compliment in a way, you know. I mean, and you know, you've got a really successful, effective character when people feel that way. But at the same time, I think the relationship of a writer to a character is very different to the relationship of a reader. You know, a reader spends, you know, with a big trilogy, might spend 3 weeks or 6 weeks with those characters. For you, it's 3 years or 6 years, you know. And to try and maintain a kind of freshness and a reason to work with that character, rather than just bringing them in because you can, is difficult. And I think it's very easy to stagnate and kind of, you know, I'm sure people would up to a point buy more and more Logan books, but I think that'd be the death of a thousand cuts, you know, in a way. They'd gradually get bored. There wouldn't be a kind of savage backlash as there is if I, you know, there probably would be if I decided to write romance or something wildly different. But there's going to be a gradual loss of interest if you're endlessly just doing the same thing. And, you know, you get bored. You get bored, or, you know, you at least get stale going over the same ground. And I think it's very important as a writer to keep challenging yourself, to keep trying to do new things, different things, because the minute you're not interested in what you're doing, I think you can't possibly expect readers to be interested.
Well, and so I remember after you published Red Country, there was talk of you taking sort of a hiatus or a little break from writing, and there was sort of the joke that when you announced Half a King, it was sort of like, haha, there's what kind of hiatus is that, Joe? But But I have to wonder if part of that desire for a hiatus was the fact that you did go back to Logan, that it's kind of the first time you'd reused a character of that scale in one of your standalone books. And do you think that played into part of that sort of exhaustion and wanting to take some time off, that you went back to him?
I don't think it was so much that. I mean, I don't think it was him particularly as a character. I think there was it was more just the working with that world, with that tone, with those sort of characters. I mean, it's great to have an established world and to have all this stuff to draw on that you don't necessarily have to, you know, draw a map at the start of every book because you've got maps already, if you like. Likewise, you don't necessarily have to come up with a full cast of characters because you've got some characters on the hook you can kind of bring back in. But there is a sort of weight to having an established world you've written a lot of books in. There's all these characters hanging around who all have a history. And, you know, I can remember writing Red Country, I forget who the characters were, but I had a scene between two characters. I suddenly realized they knew each other. You know, they'd met each other before, and I'd forgotten. Or, you know, another inquisitor, one of the inquisitors in Red Country, I was calling him the wrong name. I was calling him the name of a guy who died and before they're hanged. Right up until near the end, and then I thought I'd better scan through the trilogy and make sure I haven't made any howling mistakes. And I had made a load of howling mistakes, or a couple anyway. So there's a sort of weight to you know, endlessly working in the same world, and I just felt like I needed to kind of get away from that and spread my wings a bit, if you like, with something new, and just try something quick and sharp and a little bit different, a palate cleanser, a sorbet between courses, you might say. So that was really more the impulse. You know, working with Logan again was good because I hadn't had him in, you know, for a couple of books. I'd done a couple of books without him in at all, and he wasn't a point of view. He was, you know, a slightly unknown secondary character in a sense. I mean, he's important in the book, but you never see inside his head, if you like. So it didn't feel like it was overuse of Logan particularly, but, you know, just a bit of a sense of going slightly over the same ground, repeating myself very slightly, I suppose, or at any rate trying to find new ways to do slightly the same things, and those ways being a little less automatic and instinctive. So it just felt like slightly hard work at times, and I needed to try something different, I guess.
Well, I certainly think that as a reader, one of the things that draws me to you, and I think draws your other readers to you, is that no book is the same. I mean, you haven't written anything that was like what had come before. You've constantly tried a new genre, or applying another genre to the fantasy genre to kind of keep it fresh, and I think that's been really effective, but I can imagine that trick would even for you, would wear out after a while. The First Law trilogy romance novel or comedy of errors might be a bit of a stretch.
Well, it might be, though, you know, who knows what will come next.
That's right.
You know, I might have to have a try at that. Yeah, I mean, I think you've got to try and keep yourself interested, keep the readers interested. And I think there's a degree to which, you know, readers often say they want the same thing again, but actually they never quite do. You know, they're more than willing to be annoyed if they get exactly the same thing. They always want things to move on to a degree. And you've got to kind of give them what they need, not what they want, if you like. The readers are like children. You have to guide them by the nose towards where they need to be, you see. That's my way of looking at it. I think ultimately, as a writer, you've got to write the book you want to write, you know. You can't think too much about what people want. And I mean, the other problem with it is that always that, you know, no two readers want quite the same thing. One man's ingenious character study is another's, you know, cardboard microwaved rubbish. And, you know, one person's investigation of the darkness of the human condition and how far we're prepared to go for the truth is another's schlock bollocks. You know, there's just no two people are the same in their tastes, let's put it that way.
Well, that's one of the biggest challenges of any author, but in this case, moving into Half a King has got to be sort of challenging, because your readers, for the most part, are sort of going to be mostly deeply ingrained in the genre. I mean, I think that things like the First Law trilogy work best for people who are well-read within the fantasy genre. I mean, a lot of the tricks that you play are built on that. And so as you go back to Half a King, which pulls back a little bit from that, and is, I always talk about inward-looking fiction and outward-looking fiction, and in a lot of ways, the First Law trilogy is very inward-looking to the fantasy genre, where Half a King, I think, is much more outward-looking. It's saying, you know, it's sort of trying to appeal and have discussions about things that are larger than the fantasy community. And so as your readers follow you there, it is going to be different. It'll be interesting to see. I mean, the response largely has been very positive thus far, you know, from fans, but it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, fascinating for sure. I suppose I'd slightly disagree with you, not totally, but slightly about the inward lookingness. First of all, very much is about fantasy, but I think a lot of that stuff is pretty universal. I mean, how many people aren't familiar with Lord of the Rings now? Who that reads at all? I mean, Lord of the Rings is one of the biggest selling books of all time. So it's not exactly fringe stuff you're tackling when you deal with Lord of the Rings. It's not exactly niche. You know, things like King Arthur and Merlin and, you know, these are sort of, they're pillars of popular culture more than they are of genre, if you like. So, I mean, I think fantasy is very general, you know, and people, you could say in a way the same thing about Game of Thrones. You know, Game of Thrones feels like it's, it's tackling quite inward-looking stuff. It's in conversation with its with fantasy. It's a take on epic fantasy. It's an analysis of epic fantasy in some ways. But that doesn't seem to have limited the appeal of Game of Thrones. You know, that's obviously hit an unbelievably huge market now and seems to be, you know, a massive mainstream cultural thing. So I think you certainly can, you know, hit a wide audience with something that is genre, without a doubt. I sometimes get a bit kind of impatient with the inward lookingness of some of genre, as though there's a core bit that, you know, is limited, and then outside that there's a mainstream. But in fact, there's this huge grey area. You know, someone like my brother, say, he's 40. He reads very, very widely, and within what he reads, he might read, you know, Richard Morgan book. He might read a Chyna Mieville book. He might read George Martin. So, but he's also reading all kinds of other things. So I think, you know, there's a wide readership out there who are, at least to some degree, understand what fantasy is about and can recognize, you know, an inversion of a goodly wizard trope when they see it.
Yeah, no, I think there's definitely a inclination within the community. And when I say community, of course, we mean like the very small insular community of the online world and the conventional world that sort of exists in a bubble. There's definitely a desire there to keep ownership of some of this stuff. While I've got you off the subject of the new book you're selling, which
was difficult to do. You know, really, I'll stick to that like a limpet.
It's a stunning development, really. I'm just curious. Have you been following the First Law reread at all? I mean, what's it been like to have someone go through the series that closely?
Yeah, no, I've got an eye on it. I usually catch them, and you know, I usually sort of check in and see what people have been saying. I mean, I don't comment myself because that feels like, I don't know, it might kind of put a thumb on the scales with things. In a way, I'm more interested in hearing other people's interpretations of things than I am in sort of endlessly giving my own. It's fascinating to see things that to see what people make of you know, stuff that you wrote quite a long time ago. I mean, I found it very interesting to reread my stuff myself, in a way. Well, once you get, I mean, 8 years ago the Blade itself came out, I think. It's quite a long time. You certainly don't remember every detail, and so yeah, it's very interesting to see how people react to it and still reacting to it some time on. Yeah.
So I think the biggest debate that's come up in the reread has been whether or not Logan is a half-devil or not.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to ask you the question, and we'll see if I can get you to answer it. Is Logan in some way have the blood of the sons of Eus?
Well, I mean, death of the author and all that, I guess it's, you know, my opinion is maybe not the only important one. I always like things that are a bit ambiguous. I'm not a big fan of kind of, well, I mean, I'm often a fan of it when other people do it, but my own taste as a writer is for things that are a bit ambiguous, especially in magic, that don't answer every question, that aren't systematized, you know. I like magic to be unpredictable and wild and unknowable to a degree. So for me, the kind of what is the Bloody Nine question, I'm not sure it's one that needs answering or that it's helpful to give a definitive answer to. I think my way of looking at it is it's not necessary, I don't think, really, to posit a supernatural explanation. You know, I think it's it being a kind of dissociative personality or a split personality or a kind of a berserker type feature is believable enough. That works enough for me. But other people obviously see it a little bit differently. Yeah. I think one of the nice things about fantasy is, you know, you can work with characters that are a bit larger than life. You're not going for a totally realistic, you know, truly realistic and believable feel necessarily. People can be larger than life. They can be that little bit superhuman. I think you'd miss that in fantasy if everyone was entirely humdrum and they, you know, they kept dying of flu and stuff.
the bloody flux.
Well, the bloody flux, maybe there'd be a point to be made there, but yeah, generally you want your characters to die in a way that services the narrative rather than just to, you know, pop their clogs at random.
So I guess part of that question then is, and I'm kind of glad there's no easy answer there. I mean, I enjoy that debate and
well, exactly. Would there be no one left to comment if all the questions got answered? Would there?
Exactly. But I guess one of the questions I always love is, you've written 6 books in this world now, and if I understand correctly, you're under contract for 3 more still, at
yeah.
least. With Gallants, and I don't know if you're under contract in the U.S. or not for those books.
I think I am, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, you think? That's good.
I think so. Well, Gallants hold the world rights, so they're certainly sold by me to them, and they then sell them on to other people.
Okay.
So it's kind of that's not my deal quite in the same way.
Okay. Yeah. So how many of these answers do you actually have? And so, because one of these great questions is, you know, we didn't get a map of the first law world, the circle of the world, until quite a long time in. And I still don't think we have a definitive map, although there was, if I remember correctly, some picture in one of the graphic novel pages that created like the storm of people trying to determine if that was the map. And so there's all these sort of world building details, and we just talked about the Logan thing right now. And I, you know, do you even know the answer to the question of whether or not he is or is not? And do you, how many of these details do you have on a hard drive somewhere, and how many of them do you know are unanswered?
Difficult question. I mean, certainly some of them that I know. I mean, you know, with maps, say, I mean, I've always had a map of the circle of the world, because it's kind of necessary to work out what makes sense and what doesn't. But I've not always been comfortable with putting it out there necessarily, because I kind of quite enjoy the flexibility of being able to change it and add in different bits and pieces as and when I need them. So I think in a way I take the same attitude to the background and the magic and a lot of the details. I mean, certainly not everything you necessarily have a decided opinion about. I don't have kind of lever arch folders crammed with elaborate notes on yellowing paper in biro and that kind of stuff. I've got things like timelines and, you know, a few things that I really need to have to make it consistent. But otherwise, I kind of make it up as I go along. I suppose that's sort of the nice thing about being a fantasy writer, is you sort of make stuff up. So I quite like that. I quite like doing that in a way. I mean, obviously you've got to try and maintain consistency and so on, and, you know, you want to know what age your characters are, what their sort of physical appearance is and things of that kind. But, you know, a lot of that you can iron out in a copy edit. I guess I'm much more interested in the writing of a book and what's in the book and what the reader's going to read than I am in the stuff the reader never will read. So I try to focus my efforts on the language and the detail of the writing and those kind of things, if it's a choice between that and kind of fleshing out the source material and the background a bit more, which in the end it sort of does become, because time is limited, I guess.
Fair enough, Joe, but think about the children. If you get a television or film deal, you're going to want to publish the definitive guide to the circle of the world. So, you know, just put
well,
it
I mean,
think
why
your
one?
Kids.
Why one? I mean, it'd be a whole series of such guides, lavishly illustrated by an illustrator.
Based on Twitter by Jeffrey Allen Love, I believe.
By Jeffrey Allen Love, yeah. Although, you know, his style's a bit impressionistic. That might not sit right with the kind of thirst for detail.
Yes, no, I love Jeff's style. I think he's an incredible
artist. Oh, yeah,
he's
great, absolutely.
But yeah, perhaps not right for that kind of project. But I'm curious, Half a King deals... I mean, it's obviously a secondary world fantasy. It's got some detail, but much like the Blade itself, it's sort of, you don't go too deep yet. You've left it sort of. Do you expect this world that you've created to be as deep as the Circle of the World as you move on in the series, or is the nature of the narratives that you're using in this going to be more? The world is just going to always be very secondary to the story you're telling. I mean, I think it always is secondary to the story you're telling, but.
Yeah, probably more so than the first one. I mean, I think naturally at a longer length of book, you're naturally going to explore more places and more of the relationships between those places. I mean, the first law is quite political, I guess, at times. So you kind of need to have an understanding of what the political situation is, who the players are, how they work in relation to each other. So there's a fair bit of that in it. I mean, it's not the focus. I always tried with that and tried with other things for the focus to be much more on the characters, if you like. I mean, I always kind of use the the metaphor of John Ford versus Sergio Leone, you know. John Ford being the sort of...
We've really learned the scope of Joe Abercrombie's ringtone during the course of this podcast.
You certainly have. Well, I'm a big fan of Westerns, as you know. So, you know, I see John Ford, I suppose, as being focused on the terrain in a way, and the setting and the big wide shots, the huge expansiveness, you know. And in a way, I see traditional fantasy being, you know, similar to that in a sense, where Sergio Leone comes along and it's all about the tight shots, the eyes, the details, the kind of the sweat on the skin, the intimate stuff. And I feel like Martin took things much more in that direction, much more intimate focus on the individuals. Although, you know, he does also, of course, a lot of world building as well. But my taste and my aim with the First Law and those other books was always to keep very tightly focused on the characters. With shorter books like Half a King, it becomes even more necessary. You know, you don't have the space to necessarily expound widely on what's going on. So you need to get across what's necessary. And I think you need to make the elements of the setting which that character interacts with, those have got to have some originality and some interest to them. They've got to have come alive. But in terms of drawing a big picture, yeah, probably not. Not so much. I mean, I've got some ideas about how one might go about doing that, and about, you know, what's in different corners of the world that can be referenced at odd moments, you know, to give it a sense of there being a wider world out there. But certainly the focus is very much on the kind of the principal characters and their day-to-day struggles, if you like.
Right. All right. Well, LenCon is approaching. I will be in London, and I've heard that you've developed a bit of a reputation for dance battles.
Is that a fact? I think I've only actually done one.
Well, the myth of it has really expounded, and
it has expounded. I lost very, very badly.
Now, Tom Pollock is your nemesis, right?
Well, I mean, I think my nemesis is, it's a bit unfair to him to call him a nemesis, because it implies a kind of an equality, doesn't it? It implies we're on some sort of an even level, which we're most definitely not.
Does he cut a rug?
He does cut a rug, and I think he's about 10 years younger than me as well. So, you know, he's got more fluid in the joints. What can I say? My knees don't bend as far as his.
And hair, so he's very aerodynamic, perhaps.
Extremely aerodynamic, that's right. No hair, no beard, whereas, you know, I've got all this fuzz to drag. Although less hair than I used to have, there's no doubt of that.
So will you be dancing at LenCon? I mean, can we mark that down?
Well, I mean, I don't know what the event will be where dancing will occur. I suppose that's the other thing. You know, at FantasyCon, there's a definite delineated disco area within.
Really?
And one can see, you know, it's not just me and Tom Pollock. Let's get that out of the way. I mean, that was the dance-off, but Brent Weeks was there, you know, cutting a few moves,
I like to imagine.
Brent Weeks can bust a move or two. There's no doubt of that.
I like to imagine him doing sort of like the sprinkler or some kind of obscure dance move.
A lot of pointing, but in a very controlled way. There was a kind of, it seemed that he was indicating plot points around the room. And, you know, you couldn't take your eyes off the man. He definitely had a twinkle to his toes, without a doubt.
He's very charismatic. So hopefully we can organize something like that at LenCon. I'll get with the tour.com people. Absolutely. And see if we can put on a discotheque.
Definitely. I'll make sure I'm somewhere else.
don't avoid me, Joe.
But once was it one time? I think one dance-off was probably enough. The other problem was that, you know, traditionally in a dance-off, you're supposed to alternate, I think, really, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm not an expert, to be honest, but, you know, one person displays their, you know, best moves. The other then takes the floor and, you know, answers, if you like. There's an ask and answer approach to it, whereas on this one we both just went in each other's faces right from the off, and frankly I ran out of puff. I ran out of energy. I was looking tired after maybe 30 seconds. I don't have the staying power that I used to have, so, you know, God knows what it'd be like this time around. Probably 10 seconds and I'd absolutely be flat out.
Yeah, you just had to get off the pitch. I mean, after World Cup talk and erectile dysfunction talk, the conversation about your staying power has a different tone, so.
Well, you know, people are free to make whatever conclusions from that they like.
All right. Well, on that note, thanks for coming on, Joe. Good luck with Half a King. And
thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
I'll do my best not to creep you out during the remainder of the first law.
No, I look forward to it. All right, the creepiness and everything else, the full range of human experience.
All right, excellent. We'll see you in London.
Yeah, look forward to it.
All right, thanks, Joe.
Cheers.